Good afternoon. Thank you for being on the second edition of the Talking Seniors podcast. My name is Anthony Ania. I'm the managing member of the firm of Ania Scanlon and Serignano of White Plains, New York, with also an office in Somers, New York. We are an elder law firm in Westchester County, and we serve the tri-state area. And I look forward to helping you and with your elder law needs. Today, in the second edition of our podcast, I have as our guest Charles J. Newman. Chuck is the principal owner of the Charles J. Newman Company in Peekskill, New York. And we're going to talk to Chuck a little bit today about long-term care insurance and kind of the issues that seniors need to be aware of when they're examining the possibility of purchasing long-term care insurance. Chuck, why don't you introduce yourself and just say a few things about your firm and your career?
Well, thank you so much, Anthony. And, you know, we've known each other a long time. Our paths cross a lot because we're dealing with seniors and their needs, as we've been for almost 30 years together, I think. So my firm is a life and health insurance brokerage. We work with both individuals and with companies. Here today, we're talking about long-term care insurance, which is written for individuals to basically help them protect themselves from the high cost of long-term care in this country. And as we go along, we'll talk about the ins and outs of it, some of the different types of products that are available in the marketplace to help you through those different concerns.
So Chuck, as one ages, why is it important for seniors to consider the purchase of long-term care insurance? What are the main reasons and objectives of having it?
At the end of the day, it's really about protecting one's assets, and kind of that's really where I think both of our practices are coming assisting seniors. With elder law, you're helping seniors preserve their assets, preserve what they've worked for their entire lifetime. With insurance, it's really the same thing. So they kind of go together as a, perhaps a belt and suspenders approach. But with respect to insurance, look, we hope we'll never need insurance. None of us like paying for insurance, but to some extent, we all have to purchase insurance for our homes, for our cars, for our health. And in this case, it's really it's not a mandatory purchase, but it's one that people should consider if they're really looking at what if I need long-term care, how will I pay for that? Will I pay for that of my own assets, out of my savings? Where will that money come from? And that really is at the heart of why people consider long-term care insurance.
And it's a major issue as seniors age, because what people don't realize, sometimes they focus on the fact that they may need to go to a nursing home, but that is not predominantly where seniors are spending their time. They're spending most of their time at home, and they need care at home. And that care at home can be very expensive if you don't have long-term care insurance. It could be anywhere from $6,000 a month to $15,000 a month, depending on the number of hours one needs, especially if you're paying for it privately and you're going through a private provider, a long-term care agency, a home care agency. It could be quite expensive.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was going to just add, it's expensive, but it's also that sometimes people don't know what the solutions might be to keep them independent, to keep them in their own homes, and to allow them to avail themselves of other resources. For instance, if they're on their own, if their spouse has passed on, or if they were never married, either way, or married, divorced. You know, they're on their own. So who else is there if the kids are far away? And that's kind of the situation today for a lot of seniors. Their children are not in the community. Here, at least with an insurance policy, there are other resources. There are care coordination benefits. There are people that can help you coordinate your own care.
Well, that's one of the problems that we're facing, is that there is no such thing as a nuclear family anymore. You know, it used to be that multi-generations would live in the same neighborhood, in the same town, sometimes in the same house. But now you don't have that. Seniors are finding that their kids are all over the country, and it's just impossible for them to rely on their children for any help. So that creates the need to have somebody else to come in to the house to take care of them. And that poses its own set of issues and problems. And having the ability to pay for that through long-term care insurance is very important. In your experience, what is the ideal age for someone to go out and purchase the insurance?
And people ask me that all the time about lots of different types of insurance, including life insurance. And I don't mean to be trite when I say this, but I say, when you're healthy, and when you're insurable, because it's not a given that we are insurable. There are things that come up in our lives, in our bodies, in our physiology that would ultimately preclude us from obtaining insurance, whether it's long-term care insurance, life insurance, disability insurance. If you had to ask me, the quick answer is when you're healthy and insurable. The longer answer is the average age of purchase of long-term care insurance really is in the mid-50s now. And the reason it is in the mid-50s is, think about it, we who are in our 50s are dealing with folks, our parents. We've seen what happens with our grandparents. Maybe we've seen aunts and uncles who've needed long-term care. So we're kind of impacted by what that means, what the potential costs are for that, and what all the issues are that are attendant to it. So if I had to quantify it, I would say it's really someone who's, again, in good health enough to purchase and to be insurable for long-term care insurance, but whose average age in the 50s these days.
So that kind of leads me to my next question is, with respect to the actual insurability, what are some of the factors that make someone insurable or non-insurable? And also, what are the things that rate the policy for long-term care? For example, is it having a heart condition, or is it more having physical incapacities and physical disabilities?
Well, for the latter, if you already have, if you're already ADL, activity of daily living, ADL impaired in some way, if you are lacking the ability to ambulate, to get around on your own, if you have to use a multi-pronged cane, for instance, if you need assistance going from sitting to standing, getting in and out of bed, then you're already part of the way down what would ordinarily be a claim situation for long-term care. You're not insurable for long-term care. If you have a disease that is considered degenerative, where over time, whether it's Parkinson's or MS or something like that, where the expectation is that you will lose your ability to do those things, you're probably not insurable. If you have a heart condition, which you mentioned before, Anthony, a lot of people have heart disease. It really depends the extent to which it's managed. If you've already had a stroke or a TIA, you may be insurable. It depends how far back into the past that occurred and to what extent it left any kind of lasting impact to your body. And do you have any residual impacts from that? So in general, I would have to say it's someone who has no physical impairments currently, who doesn't have a disease that's degenerative in nature, and whatever condition you have, which is not as severe to that extent, is under control with medications and is not necessarily expected to worsen over time.
Okay. So really, like somebody has type 2 diabetes and has no other, other factors that
correct.
Would affect
no their, comorbidities, yes.
Or affect their ability to perform activities of daily living, walking, dressing, feeding, bathing, toileting, they may be still eligible for long-term care insurance.
Oh, for sure.
As they may be rated.
As long as, correct, as long as their sugar is under control, their hemoglobin A1C is under control, presumably they're insurable. The other issue is weight. Depending upon their weight, that could be a situation where they might not be insurable if they're severely overweight. But all those things, there are multiple factors that might cause either an insurance premium to be higher, as you're terming it, a rated premium, that's possible, or completely uninsurable, depending upon the combination of conditions that someone might have.
Can you provide some examples for our audience as to the types of insurance one would consider, whether one wants a lump sum benefit, whether it's a daily benefit, and if it is a daily benefit, how many years worth of coverage they should consider? And also there's this thing called the elimination period. So maybe just touch a little bit on all those three factors for a few seconds.
Absolutely. When I first started selling long-term care insurance in the 1990s, the only type of policy that was out there, and American Express was really first to market with long-term care insurance, was what we today call a standalone long-term care insurance policy. A standalone policy provides no other benefit than for long-term care. If you never need long-term care, there's no benefit that's paid out. But with that type of a policy, you purchase either a daily or a monthly benefit. And when you get to the point where you cannot perform 2 out of 6 activities of daily living, as I mentioned before, those ADLs, getting in and out of bed, going from sitting to standing, you need human supervision or assistance, feeding yourself, dressing yourself, using the toilet, that's when you can go and claim on a policy. So with those kinds of policies, they would pay out a daily benefit. Let's say it's $300 a day for a finite period of time. That period of time could be 3 years, it could be 4 years, could be longer. And it would start paying out after an elimination period. Elimination period is also could be thought of as your deductible. It's the time when you're paying out of pocket for long-term care services before that policy kicks in. So a typical elimination period, 90 days. So you have all of a sudden either there's a specific event, you've been insured by this policy, and you have a specific event like a stroke, which causes you to become incapacitated. That first 90 days of service when you're receiving long-term care services would be your elimination period. Then benefits would commence on the 91st day and continue to pay out that same $300 a day in my example, or maybe you purchase a $9,000 monthly benefit. There's a small distinction there between a daily benefit, which is capped. Let's say if it's $300 a day, you can't go over that. But if you have a $9,000 a month benefit, you can use that $9,000 up within the first maybe 2 weeks of the month, have nothing left for the rest of the month. But you may need care during a more intensive period during that month. So it's up to you. It gives you a little more flexibility. So that's called a standalone policy where it pays a defined amount of money for either daily or monthly after a certain waiting period and for a defined period of time. Long-term care insurance policies evolved over time to include life insurance. And that's what we call kind of a hybrid model today. The hybrid model says that, hey, if you never need long-term care benefits, there'll be a death benefit because it's a life insurance policy. But if you do need long-term care benefits, you will spend down what would have otherwise been a death benefit to pay for long-term care. And that comes in a couple of main varieties. One is pretty typically a permanent life insurance policy. It's generally speaking what's called a guaranteed universal life policy. So let's say you purchase a $500,000 life insurance policy. If you need long-term care, you could spend that $500,000 down at the rate of $10,000 a month for 50 months until you've exhausted your life insurance benefit. There would always be a small residual benefit, maybe $10,000 or $20,000 that would still go to your beneficiaries in that scenario. If you never need long-term care, $500,000 goes to your beneficiaries at your passing. So that's one of the main types. The other is a lump sum, as you alluded to before, Anthony, where let's say I'm working, I just submitted an application for a client yesterday, 56 years old, it's a $100,000 lump sum, which will ultimately provide well over $400,000 toward long-term care insurance. And if she never needs long-term care, around $200,000 and change, depending upon the year in which she passes, for a life insurance benefit.
So when you say lump sum, it's really the premium is paid in a lump sum.
Premiums paid in a lump sum, but the interesting aspect to those policies is depending upon the year, for instance, typically after a certain period of time, after a number of years, 5, 10, 15 years, the entire amount of that premium, in this case $100,000, is available back to you should you choose to cancel and surrender that policy for whatever reason. If your life changed, you don't need that benefit anymore, you could cash out of it and cancel that policy in the lump sum scenario. It can also be built to have an increasing benefit over time. So in this case, the $100,000 is purchasing an initial benefit, which is smaller than it will ultimately grow to, I think by the time this person is in her 80s, we're up to a benefit over $9,500, almost $10,000 a month for long-term care, whereas it's starting out at a much lower level, maybe $6,000 or $7,000 a month.
Right. And what most consumers don't understand is that you don't really go out and buy a policy that would cost, that would, you know, give you, let's say, $20,000 a month worth of coverage, which is ideal, but that was is going to run you quite a bit of money in premiums.
Correct.
If you're getting 20,000, what you're looking for is a policy, A, that's going to give you some coverage, right, whether it be $5,000 or $10,000 a month, and that you can then utilize your income to pay for the rest of the cost of long-term care, so that you're not dipping into your savings to use to pay for long-term care. So talking about different types of policy, we talked about the hybrid. We didn't touch on the state certified policy yet, but before we get to that, one unique thing in long-term care policies is this cost of living increase, the COLA clause. Why don't you just touch a little bit about that and explain that to our audience, because there's going to be people who always say to me, you know, how much of a cost of living increase do I want? Because it's part of the premium. It's factored in there.
When you purchase the policy, let's say we purchase a policy in 2020 for $10,000 a month. If you're in your 50s during that average age or early 60s, that $10,000 a month isn't going to go quite as far 20, 25 years from now when you ultimately might need that benefit. So I always recommend having a cost of living or COLA, cost of living adjustment, in your policy. Used to be that those cost of living adjustments were 5%, sometimes 5% compound. Those policies today, to get a 5% compound is very expensive. So most of the policies today are 3% compound, or 3% simple interest, which allows for your benefit to increase a little bit above the overall general rate of inflation, but at least to keep pace with increasing costs. That kind of an increase can take place whether it is a standalone policy that I described at the outset, or that kind of lump sum policy. It may not occur, however, if you go with the hybrid model I described before. You get that $500,000 death benefit for life insurance, that's really going to stay somewhat static, and that benefit won't necessarily increase over time. However, a main distinction between those life insurance-based long-term care policies with long-term care benefits and the standalone is that those standalone policies, where you're purchasing a $300 a day benefit, $9,000 a month benefit, the premiums on those policies are not guaranteed. They're not guaranteed to stay level for your lifetime. What is guaranteed is the insurance company can't raise your rates because you had a claim or something like that after you were approved. They have to
raise the rates for the entire class of people.
That's correct.
They have to go back to the state insurance department to do that. But what's been happening over the last couple of years, they've been able to get those increases.
Well, they got the increases, and the justification that the insurance companies give in requesting those increases is, look, we need to be able to pay claims. So we won't be able to pay our claims if we can't get an increase on this block of business.
Right.
Now, the increases are granted. They're not always granted to the extent that the insurance companies request, but they are generally granted. And unfortunately, a lot of people who purchase policies which were undervalued by the insurance companies, not well underwritten by the insurance companies, to the extent that the insurance companies really didn't quantify the risks when they issued them in the 90s and early 2000s, those policies have gotten a lot of premium increases, those standalone policies.
One thing good about, even when the increases have happened, is the insurance company has given you a variety of different options. You could reduce the elimination period or increase the elimination period. You could also reduce the COLA rate that you had.
Correct.
So they've given ways that you can still keep the policies active, still maybe growing, but not growing at the same rate.
That's right. And some people who've had that 5% compound cost of living adjustment where the policy benefit has grown exponentially, excuse me, over time, have decided at that point when they've gotten those increase letters to kind of throttle back on some of their benefits.
Right. Sure. If you bought a $250 a day benefit 15, 20 years ago and you had 5% compounding, well, that could be a $500 a day benefit now.
Exactly. Boy, I would take 5% compounding in my savings anytime.
Yeah, I'll take it. So We didn't get into the state certified policies. And that's something that I go back to because I was actually involved at the state bar level in dealing with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and creating the state certified policies. So let's talk about them. They're not as popular vehicles as they used to be, but they're still there. So there's still this option.
Well, in terms of asset protection, we said at the outset, we come at asset protection and our different practices in different ways. With regard to long-term care insurance, it helps protect assets because you have a policy that's going to pay a benefit and rather than taking it out of your savings. But the New York State Partnership for Long-Term Care took that one step further and said that if you have a policy that meets the minimum parameters for state certification, as you term it, under the New York State Partnership, and you pay for this policy in good faith, then when you need long-term care, if you have to go on claim, you can pay with that policy that you have. And then over and above that policy, once that policy benefit is exhausted and you still need to pay for long-term care, your assets are protected. And you could potentially go on Medicaid, even though you have assets that exceed the Medicaid limits.
That's correct. You have to exhaust the benefits of the policy. So if you bought a policy that gave you 3 years worth of coverage at $300 a day, you've exhausted the benefits, whether it's for home care or nursing home. You're now eligible for Medicaid and you can have $1 million in the bank. However, if you have $1 million in the bank, or if you have $1 million IRA, you're going to have income, and that income is not protected.
That's correct. And a number of years ago, the New York State Partnership for Long-Term Care had always been unlimited asset protection. A number of years ago, to make policies a little bit more affordable, the partnership also certified dollar-for-dollar asset protection, which meant that if you have a policy which pays out $300,000 over time, you could protect $300,000 of your own assets from Medicaid if you needed to avail yourself of Medicaid after your policy benefits were exhausted. So there are those two varieties. However, as you said at the beginning of this question, those policies are not as popular as they used to be. And one primary reason why is the expense. The policies just are not really meeting a lot of needs for folks these days, unless they're young enough when they purchase them that the mandated benefits, such as the certain minimum benefits that they have, the minimum waiting periods, the minimum benefit duration, the cost of living adjustments, if it's affordable for them, then it makes a lot of sense for folks who are already in their 70s, perhaps late 60s, 70s. It may just not be affordable. And then we're really looking at getting a policy that provides the most benefit we can for the premium that's affordable for those individuals.
Yeah. Look, the decision to buy long-term care insurance has a definite number of components to it. But I think if you can afford it, you definitely should consider it and purchase it. But one thing that I find that clients don't do is they go out and buy the long-term care insurance, but then they say, oh, gee, I got the insurance. I don't need to do any long-term care planning. And I think that's a mistake, because if you have the insurance, that kind of buys you the ability to give assets away, to create a Medicaid asset protection trust, or do the gifting that's necessary to start the process of protecting assets. People think, well, gee, if I give assets away, I'm not going to get Medicaid for 5 years. But if you hold on to the assets, you may never get Medicaid because you're not going to be eligible. So you're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. So what most clients that really are astute do is they buy the long-term care insurance, and then they leverage the policy that they've purchased by doing elder law planning, by trying to take some of their assets, their house, some of their savings, and transferring it to a Medicaid asset protection trust. Because once they've done that, they've created the 5-year look back, and now we have a new 30-month look back for home care Medicaid as well. So by creating that look back, they're starting the clock running on protecting the assets that they got out of their name. And if something were to happen to them during the 5-year look back, they have the long-term care insurance.
add a long-term care insurance. And once that period is finished and they find that they're comfortable with the asset protection that they have using the trust, maybe they could even drop the long-term care insurance policy. Maybe they don't need to continue it. It really becomes a personal choice back then and what gives them peace of mind.
Yeah. I mean, if you have somebody that's astute and let's say they're 60 or 65 years of age and they have long-term care insurance and they know that there's a risk of getting dementia in the family. Mom had dementia, dad had dementia. One of their older brothers had dementia. So in that situation, they have the insurance. It really makes sense to leverage that policy. I like to call it the buffer. That policy is the buffer during that period of time that's created by you making the gift and transferring the assets out of your name. So there are many things that can be done to protect and shelter assets. I think I've always thought that long-term care insurance was a key component of that. But unfortunately, you know, you'll get, you know, readings, you'll see things that say, well, gee, long-term care insurance is not worth it. But I think those are mistaken. I think,
you know, it's like a lot of the financial press is very generalized and it's not specific to any individual's situation.
Right.
Everyone owes it to themselves to do their own financial planning, to consult with an elder law attorney, to think about the insurance. There's no one size fits all approach. There really isn't. People, even when it comes to life insurance, ask me, well, you know, how much, what's the right, you know, multiple of my salaries? Right. You know, there's no one size fits all to that. We need to know what your debt situation is, what, you know, how many children you have, who you need to take care of, whether you want to make any gifts to charities, that kind of a thing. So it really can't be generalized.
Are there any trends that you're seeing in the insurance business that would affect seniors and it's something they should think about? Is there something that's up on the horizon as you see, you know, we have the baby boomers aging. I don't remember what the number is, 80, 85 million baby boomers coming of age every day. Thousands and thousands of baby boomers hit 65 years of age. Eventually, some of these people are going to need long-term care. And when they do need it, if they don't have the insurance and they've done no long-term care planning, they are truly in a very difficult spot. So is there some insurance trend that you're seeing now?
Well, the trend that I'm seeing more often than not is away from the standalone policies, is toward the life insurance model. With the life insurance model, it does involve permanent life insurance. So there's a much higher premium for permanent life insurance than there is for term life insurance. A lot of people purchase term life insurance in the mistaken belief that they will not need life insurance as they get older, as they age. Life insurance traditionally was looked at to provide income for a spouse at the death of a breadwinner for the family. Life insurance was looked at to pay for education for their children should that breadwinner pass on in an untimely way. But that's no longer necessarily the case when we're talking about long-term care. Life insurance can play a huge role regardless of whether there's a long-term care component. Why? Because at your passing, if you spent for your long-term care needs $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, well, guess what? There's a benefit that will go back to your family, to your spouse, to your loved ones, to replenish the savings that you had worked your whole lifetime for and put away for them or for yourself for your own retirement. So if there is a trend, I think it's really taking another look at life insurance and different reasons to own life insurance as you age and have a permanent life insurance policy rather than a term life policy.
Well, I get the comment all the time from a lot of my clients that say, well, gee, you know, I have $1 million in my 401k. So when I get to 72, I'm going to have to start taking my required minimum distribution. And that required minimum distribution is going to disqualify me for Medicaid. So why do I need to do long-term care planning? I'm probably never going to be on Medicaid. Yes, but that income that you're going to be taking from your required minimum distribution, that was there for other purposes, for your lifestyle, for your wife's lifestyle, your children, your grandchildren. And now there's no way of replenishing it when you spend it. But if you have the insurance and you've done the planning, you know, it's like the apple pie. You know, every time you take a slice away from the apple pie, there's less for the family. So the more money you're spending, whether it's coming from your required minimum distribution, which you're paying tax on,
sure,
to start off with, unless you know you can get the deduction for your medical expenses, including long-term care, and that would have to be a significant amount that you're spending in order to meet that deduction. I think it's 5% of your adjusted gross income before you can actually make the deduction. So, you know, it seems to me that insurance has been and continues to be an integral part of planning for seniors as time goes by. I think you would agree.
No, I agree. And going back to what I said at the outset, nobody really likes paying for insurance, but we like that the aspect of what it does for us gives us peace of mind.
Right.
And it also is really an integral part of an overall financial plan. If we don't do certain things, if our savings don't accumulate the way that we thought that they would, or if we still have a mortgage going out into our 70s and 80s, the life insurance really is that safety net for our spouse, for our family, so that we really don't have to worry about them as long as we know those premiums are paid and there's a guaranteed death benefit that'll come to them. And as I said before, if we've had to spend money down because of a long-term healthcare need, at least we know that that money will come back to the family.
Chuck, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. I think we covered a lot. If you just don't mind, can you give the name of your firm and your address and telephone number?
Sure. It's Charles Newman Company in Peekskill. We can be found on the web at charlesnewman.com. We're at 906 South Street in Peekskill. And my email is chuck@charlesnewman.com. And our phone number is 914-345-1000.
So Chuck and his family have a long history with the city of Peekskill. And I know he's very proud of the accomplishments of the city over the last decade or so. So that's why Chuck's in Peekskill. Is that correct?
I'm third generation business owner here. My grandfather, Charles Newman, came to Peekskill in 1933.
Well, congratulations. And again, thank you for being on my podcast, Talking Seniors. And I hope to see you and talk to you soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Appreciate the opportunity.